How many memes does it take to really explain the nuance of online radicalizing subcultures? 6, 7. I'm Matthew Remsky. That was an anti-fascist dad joke. Welcome to episode 6, a dare wrapped in a joke, wrapped in a void, with my guest, self-described feral and autistic scholar of internet systems and culture, TikTok master Cy Cantarell.
If you're looking at a swirl of cryptic memes and trying to reverse engineer a motive, you're going to misread this story. What looks like politics is often subculture. What looks like a manifesto is sometimes a dare wrapped in a joke, wrapped in a void.
So yeah, that's Cantarell coining this episode's title, but she's here today also to open what will be an ongoing conversation about perhaps the strangest, most contradictory and opaque space in this era of rising fascism, which is the memosphere or manosphere or whatever you'd like to call it. Future guests in this zone will be Dale Baran. He's the author of It Came From Something Awful, and tech and social media independent journalist Taylor Lorenz.
It's like, I don't know how you can go out and protest the structure of the entire economic system if you can't keep your room organized.
Right, housekeeping. You can find me on Blue Sky and Instagram under my name, Matthew Remsky, and at YouTube as Anti-Fascist Dad, all one word. Also under TikTok under that handle, where I try to post 3 to 4 mini essays a week. I've been doing a lot on the Scott Galloway book and his media blitz, which has been really interesting. So I take clips from Morning Joe and CNN and The View and things like that and give a little bit of a commentary on the difference, especially between what the book is and what's contained in the book and how he much more aggressively, sort of prosecutes his themes when he's on these media spots. Patreon is at Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast. And I'll just remind you that it's a temporary paywall for what I want to be educational content that's freely available to everybody. So today, you'll hear the first half of my interview with Cy Cantarell, and then you'll be able to catch the second half on Patreon at Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast. As always, in the show notes, you'll see a pre-order link for the book that this podcast is based on and supporting, Anti-Fascist Dad: Urgent Conversations with Young People in Chaotic Times. Publication date is April 26th, 2026. In Fascist Squish and Anti-Fascist News of the Week, a little bit of an extended segment this time around with less clear boundaries between these categories, because I'm recording this in the glow of Zohran Mamdani winning the mayoral election for New York City. I'm not alone in having followed him obsessively since back in the spring when he was polling in single digits. My kids have picked up on him from, you know, all of my interest. I've shared bits of his speeches, TikToks. We've discussed the towering obstacles of Islamophobia and capitalist realism that he's faced, you know, with a smile and incredible humor and great social media presence. And on that Tuesday night of his win, he didn't pull any punches with regard to the national and international significance of his win.
Together, we will usher in a generation of change. And if we embrace this brave new course, rather than fleeing from it, we can respond to oligarchy and authoritarianism with the strength it fears, not the appeasement it craves. After all, if anyone can show a nation betrayed by Donald Trump how to defeat him, it is the city that gave rise to him. And if there is any way to terrify a despot, it is by dismantling the very conditions that allowed him to accumulate power. This is not only how we stop Trump, it's how we stop the next one. So, Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have 4 words for you. Turn the volume up.
Now, before going to bed, the 13-year-old asked me the same question he asked the morning after Trump's second electoral win. What's going to happen? And I realized that in this moment, there's a tension between hope and reality. And I didn't want to guide him too far into either pool, either eddy. And so I said, well, for now, good people will soak up the rare ray of sunshine in a really bad time. They will feel thrilled. They should feel thrilled at the accomplishment of an outsider. They should study how the campaign mobilized 90,000 volunteers, how Mamdani turned his campaign into a social and educational movement, how he gave these lessons in New York City radical history on social media, sitting behind this like formal desk and giving lessons on, you know, old figures from labor and queer rights movements, and also how he didn't seem to back down on any of his core values. One of his last campaign events was in this huge gay nightclub. I said that Mamdani's win made it clear that fascism in the U.S. is not unopposed. So that's the anti-fascism plug for this segment. Mamdani is pretty much inviting confrontation with the feds, not only because of his politics, but because of his identity and the rampant racism and Islamophobia of the administration. But I also said that his ability to put even modest progressive policies into action regarding rent and housing and transport and childcare will be a bloody trench war, not just because the Trumpian superstructure will do everything from cutting funding to stalling building projects to ramping up street violence through ICE in order to punish the city and discipline its leftists for this electoral result. He will also be obstructed by the squishes, the layers on layers of liberal bureaucracy that generally reinforce the capitalist status quo. The capacity to turn New York City into a socialist island or commune is limited by its dependence on the state and the will of mainstream Democrats to change too much too quickly or to question or abandon their own power structures or funding streams. And this is why the reactionary leadership of the Democratic Party, from Schumer and Jeffries to Pete Buttigieg and Hillary Clinton, just couldn't manage to endorse the guy, even though his opponent, Andrew Cuomo, got smashed in the primary, and oh, he also happens to be a sex assaulter. I also got to mention, I didn't talk about this with the kid, but there's another manifestation of squishiness here. Bill Ackman is a New York City businessman and Israel supporter who's worth over $9 billion. And as Mamdani rose in the polls, he was very active in propping up Cuomo and organizing some sort of counter strategy against this socialist insurgency, quote unquote. But the night that Mamdani won, he tweets out, I think kind of shamelessly, Zoran Mamdani, congrats on the win. Now you have a big responsibility. If I can help New York City, just let me know what I can do. Now that's a really fast flip. And it's a sign of the additional challenge that Mamdani faces. The smiles of billionaires who can fund a washout like Cuomo up to the brink with their pocket change, but then say that they want to help you, the progressive. That squishy capacity to switch sides is a hallmark of both liberal and right-wing political technique. And so we have to ask ourselves soberly what would happen if Mamdani opened his administration to the influence of Ackman. So it was short, but I think we covered some good details in that little exchange, the 13-year-old and I. Maybe later, as it plays out, it will also be interesting to think through together some of the more difficult topics, like the fact that for some folks, Mamdani is already squishy and the political crush is already wearing off. For instance, there are many Palestinian Liberation Movement people who are concerned over concessions he's made to pro-Israel interests, ostensibly to broaden his support. For instance, he disavowed "Globalize the Intifada" as a slogan. He promised that he would include Zionists in his administration. He agreed that Palestinians should lay down their arms and that he would retain Police Commissioner Tish, who comes from a billionaire family. And, you know, this is the person who presided over the brutal police crackdowns on the encampment protesters. Now, some folks were also kind of taken aback when in the midst of Trump murdering random civilians, I think the body count now is up to 40, in sailboats off the coast of Venezuela, Mamdani echoed the White House line about Maduro being an abusive dictator, which can only really support Trump's drive to an illegal invasion and war. I really think that every young person should study Mamdani carefully. There's so much to love, from his rhetoric to his humor to his grace to his polyglot swagger and even his drip. He's put a charming face on the possibility of a new politics. He makes power appear relatable, empathetic. But if he struggles and stalls, that charm will not only not help him, but it may also cue feelings of betrayal. The sense that, as one anarchist online put it, that, quote, charismatic, well-behaved leftists within parliamentary boundaries absorb discontent that might otherwise flow into direct action, mutual aid, and organizing. So that's a conversation maybe for later. My guest today, Cy Cantarell, studies and writes about the internet with a lot of interdisciplinary nuance. And in a time in which a lot of us are anxious about the radicalizing nature of the internet's isolation and competition and all of the reactionary content spun up by influencers, I find her work really helpful, and I hope you will too. Now, there is an acute context here, because when we talk about young people, men especially, who come to represent the worst outcomes of political radicalization online, we're talking about mass shooters or assassins like Tyler Robinson, the alleged killer of Charlie Kirk. Now, Robinson allegedly left signs and omens at the scene, bullet casings engraved with references that pointed in a bunch of directions. Bella Chow showed up on one bullet casing. It's an old anti-fascist song, but it's also been taken up by various right-wing fringe groups, including followers of Kirk rival Nick Fuentes, who used it to kind of low-key threaten Kirk when he was alive. There's also a quote at the site from the Helldivers 2 game in which players ironically cosplay as fascist soldiers. The quote was, "Catch fascist," so that might refer to Kirk himself, but it's just not clear. And in trying to suss all of this out, Cantarell cut this video that went viral, and she said that, you know, the bullet casings and even whatever digital footprint they might suggest may not amount to a manifesto. And maybe we don't even get to have manifestos anymore, because young outsider men are not sitting down to type out a full vision of their political values or goals. Like, who would read it? Who has the attention span? After all, we are in the meme age of, "I ain't reading all that. I'm happy for you, though," or, "Sorry that happened." A manifesto requires a shared consensus reality, a world that the manifesto can be against, and a readership more stable than the fragmentary and shifting niches offered by online life. They would have to have a coherent view of the world in order to fully reject or overturn it with a manifesto. And so, according to Cantarell, they are daring each other to find or create meaning. They are joking with each other to feel relief or save face. And they're doing so over that chasm we all brace ourselves against: the void. Now, if this all sounds too confusing or depressing, I hope what comes through is that Cantarell's insight into the fluid and dynamic nature of online identities and politics means that a dare wrapped in a joke wrapped in a void does not condemn anonymous shitposters to never change. It doesn't warn that they are irrevocably hurtling towards fascism or violence. We're not talking about stable political commitments oftentimes, but rather a mood or affect that can be interrupted or redirected. That's part of the emerging story of Graham Platner, who we'll discuss in this episode. And it's something that a lot of parents and caregivers are already doing and experiencing multiple times a day, this interruption or redirection of a mood, an ephemeral mood. When it comes to the internet, the first thing to remember and take some relief in, Cantarell suggests, is ambivalence. For some, the internet is an inevitable right-wing pipeline, but on the other hand, it's also a lifeline for many marginalized folk. In Cantarell's view, online culture is a mirror of human social dynamics, not a distortion of them necessarily. It's a space where our oldest needs for belonging, identity, and meaning play out under new technological conditions. For Cantarell, the internet is not broken, but is rather a neutral tool shaped by broken incentives. Its architecture could foster creativity, community, and pluralism, but it's been captured by profit-driven platforms that reward outrage, irony, and despair. So what emerges is a global subcultural ecosystem where people experiment with identity and belief, often unconsciously, through memes, humor, and performance. In this view, online extremism, irony, and nihilism are not anomalies, but predictable byproducts of alienation, symptoms of societies that give people few stable roles, narratives, or futures. This swirl of coded jokes, self-contradictory ideologies, and parasocial attachments online all arise from the same emotional core, the search for belonging in a meaning-starved world. So for Cy Cantarell, the internet is a vast laboratory for human pattern-making, and it reveals in real time how people construct and defend stories about who they are and how easily those stories can slide from creativity and play into anxiety and polarization. And it's an analysis that lifts me up out of the obsessive catastrophizing and worry about who is and isn't coming across the screens in our house, because online content in this context is just like any other input. It isn't entering a hollow vessel and filling it up, whether it's the vessel of the child or the vessel of the home. It might be loud. It might be sometimes overwhelming, but it's never all there is. It is always entering into a space in which relationships are also vital. So I'll just read from Cantarell's bio here. She says, "I'm a feral scholar working outside traditional academic boundaries to investigate how infrastructures shape the human condition. I'm interested in the architectures that structure our collective sense-making, the technologies, institutions, and psychologies that organize how meaning moves and who gets to make it. My practice is rooted in what my mentor, Bob Stein, once told me the world desperately needs: talented generalists who can trace systemic patterns across domains. I studied at Rhode Island School of Design and the New School, was a visiting scholar at NYU, and co-received a 2016 Cooper Hewitt National Design Award. Now I write and consult to help people decode systems of power and meaning, to see the infrastructure underneath, and to find new ways to comprehend and create." Cy Cantarell, welcome to Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast.
Thank you, Matthew. I'm so excited to be here.
Can we dub you sort of ceremonially anti-fascist internet auntie, maybe, for this
interview? Yeah, okay, of course.
So you have been very open about being autistic. I want to start here as listeners get to know you. As people get a sense of your analytical skills, are we getting a sense of a kind of special interest or hyper-focus-fueled set of research habits on your part?
Definitely. And I think, you know, I am a elder millennial. And so when I was born in the early 80s, you know, women were not diagnosed with autism. In fact, I don't even know if they really thought that women could have autism at that point.
Right.
But I, you know, I was hyperlexic as a child, which, you know, now if you were to see that, I think you would have a better indication of what that actually meant. But I mean, immediately as a little kid, you know, my mother would tell the story about how we were walking out in the garden and she was holding my hand. I was probably about two. And I looked up at her and said, "Mom, why is God dead?" And she said, what do you mean? And I said, well, God's, in, you know, you say dead people go to heaven and God's in heaven, so God must be dead. And it's like the transitive property, you know? So she was immediately like, yeah, I got something on my hands here, you know?
Wow.
So I think that has, continued where it's like, when I look at a set of problems, I have a tendency to step back from them and want to see them from a systemic perspective, in part because I think it helps my anxiety management to be able to look at these things from not a dispassionate view, because, you know, it's not like emotions are completely divorced from it at all, but they are, it's a way of understanding dynamics that can allow me or anyone else to sort of step in and see where these things are maybe less chaotic than what we would initially think from looking at them. And so my special interests have always centered around psychology and complex systems, and especially how humans react in extremis. So that is, you know, big failures of any type that involve human actions, which I worked in airline safety for a while, so we call that human factors.
Right.
So where humans are interacting with an not fully controllable environment, what are they doing to aggravate situations and then to ameliorate situations that cause issues?
Zooming out to be able to look at patterns seems to also intersect maybe with a lived understanding of maybe social difficulty or social exclusion. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm adopted. I was adopted as a baby, but I'm still adopted. And so when we're thinking about attunement and, you know, John Bowlby is like, what do you call it?
Attachment
theory.
Ideas.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There's an aspect of emotional attunement that a child really kind of needs in order to be able to validate their lived experience. And that was just not something that I had in my family of origin. And I think in part because, you know, when you're dealing with a kid who's pretty different, and you don't have that lived experience to be able to empathize with it, it can be something like you're just looking to control instead of looking to find ways to work with.
Right.
So that was definitely something I experienced. And it also led to, again, that like hypervigilance where you're kind of like always over analyzing people's social responses, and you're looking to find ways in which you might have offended all the time and sort of mask those behaviors. And I think that's a thing that's stronger for women in general, because we're socialized to be more socially what's the word I'm looking for?
Compliant.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And so that was my lived experience. And then, of course, like being an arty kid on top of it, I think I went to a very small private school in the Deep South, and I graduated with maybe 50 kids. And so you look at my junior group photo of my class, and I'm this like the only little goth, you know, on the edge of the bleachers. So,
wow.
Yeah, I experienced a lot of that.
Yeah, and I wonder if this combination is particularly suited to sussing out fascism. So being able to step back and look at patterns of social development, but also being very attuned to the way in which you're perhaps not being supported or you're being excluded.
Yeah, and I think it's not just fascism or things that are about group identity, right? Negative or positive. It's just also this like constant observance of what makes people feel like they belong and feel like they don't belong.
Right.
And the dynamics of those groups as they interact with each other. I mean, I was hyper aware of that even in junior high school, where it was like, well, why are some people popular? What does that mean? Like, why am I existing on the outside of this? What does that mean?
Right.
So, I mean, this, and then you assume that adults have it all figured out and that there's no longer that type of dynamic going on. And then you get through these different stages of adulthood and you say, oh my God, nobody knows what they're doing. And this, no one ever grows out of this really.
Well, speaking of growing out, growing into, you know, and also like where people get stuck, to move on to some of your content speciality, there is a lot of diagnosing of young men going on at this point, given their outsized impact on online culture, especially, and then through that into politics. But figuring out what's going on in people's heads is complicated, especially with regard to, are they insiders or outsiders? So I first came across your work in a video that you did on the very ambiguous politics of Tyler Robinson, the alleged killer of Charlie Kirk. I think it went viral for really good reasons. And I have a quote from this video that I think should be on a sticker on the laptop of every misinformation reporter in the world, because you say the following, quote, "If you're looking at a swirl of cryptic memes and trying to reverse engineer a motive for Tyler Robinson's actions, you're going to misread this story. What looks like politics is often subculture. What looks like a manifesto is sometimes a dare wrapped in a joke, wrapped in a void." So I just want to break that down with you, or have you walk us through that a little bit. And maybe we can start in the middle, because I think the very important sentence that leaps out to me from that is, at least first, is what looks like politics is often subculture. Now, you have this skill for pattern recognition at a distance. You have the patterns of politics. You have the patterns of subculture. What do you mean by politics looking like subculture?
We sort of have different words for things as humans that connote a level of organization. And I think subculture is relegated to, the word subculture is relegated to the things that are kind of existing at the fringes of the dominant culture, but that does not mean that the dominant culture does not also possess the same qualities as subcultures possess. And politics is a good example of that. Politics being something that is on the world stage, being something that is validated by dominant narratives, we tend to forget that really these little camps are in groups and out groups, right? When we're talking about internet fringe cultures and then dominant internal cultures, what we're seeing is that interaction of who can use power and for what ends and at what scale. And I think they're like the people looking to cash in on the sense of connection and community that subculture provides are not just in these fringe groups, right? And it's not all malicious either. I think that's something we tend to forget too, that, you know, subcultural intersections are what help any culture to grow. Because if you don't feel like you belong to a culture, even if it's a something within the dominant culture, then you're automatically going to feel like you are at a remove from and antagonistic toward that culture. And I think that's a big component of what we're seeing with these groups.
Right.
And the alt-right pipeline, I think right-wing influencers, they're kind of trying to draw people in, or they do happen to draw people in through that shared sense identity, but as opposed to other groups. But we see that in all political identities, in all political subcultures. There's like an us versus them mentality that is not necessarily just relegated to these very, very small fringe groups.
What looks like a manifesto is sometimes a dare wrapped in a joke, wrapped in a void. Okay, so step by step, the manifesto, the dare, the joke, the void. The manifesto is whatever we can track back through somebody's internet history or their social networks to try to figure out why they did what they did. But you're saying that sometimes that manifesto looks like something else or is something else.
Yeah. And just to clarify for those who didn't see the video, but that line referred to the engravings on the bullet casings, which were found at the scene. At the time there was a lot of discourse that was focusing on defining all of the references that were on these casings and speculating on their meanings in that context. What I was sort of saying with that line is it's a bit like trying to dissect the punchline of a joke. Like it's relevant context, but it misses the point because these kinds of pieces of information, when used in this context, are less about like a puzzle to be solved and then it resolves at a total answer, and more about sending a message that is encoded to land only with a subculture. And that message is a kind of dark nihilistic joke. And that joke is like, see, look at all the normies running around and acting like any of this matters, you know?
And I guess missing that it's a joke means that this sort of technocratic unpacking of each term as though it had sort of a final definition is really going to miss the mark, because you have to know for a joke, you know, who the audience is.
Right.
And so, you know, is Bella Ciao a reference to the fact that Nick Fuentes' group was using Bella Ciao as a way of like saying goodbye to or fantasizing about the death of Charlie Kirk? Or, you know, were they ironic players of Helldivers 2, or were they actually believing that the narratives of Helldivers 2 were, you know, to be glorified or something like that? It's kind of impossible to know because you don't know who the audience for the joke was, whereas the manifesto would be ostensibly a public document.
Right. That is, a manifesto is a public document that's also written so as to make sure that as many people who are outside of the small group can understand what you're trying to lay out with your actions, right?
Right. The joke is not that.
Right. Yeah. And so this is a totally different situation where it's also like when you're talking about memes and you're talking about these sort of, I mean, even like think about political or professional jargon in some of the same context. Like if you are in a corporate job and you use a lot of acronyms and you're even joking with your work friends and colleagues about those acronyms, that's the same kind of idea where it's like, I'm, you know, like using the word QB or the using the acronym QBR, like quarterly business reports. And I'm joking about that, but it's the audience for that is a coworker who also gets the context of it. But if we sat there and defined all of the different layers of meaning for quarterly business reports, it's not really the point. The point is that we live in this absurdist culture that we have lived experience through, and those memes or those pieces of jargon or those, you know, different the video games, all of these things are a way of coalescing that identity, that shared identity.
So the acronym QBR has a technical meaning within the sort of business context that it's used, but the actual office workers can start saying it with a sneer, mm-hmm. or they can say it because it's a maybe it's a term that's thrown around as a way of you know, the manager disciplining other workers or something like that. And so the QBR takes on this set of meanings that has nothing, it's not in the text at all. You couldn't tell from the outside at all. And that's maybe part of why it's jargon. It hides a lot of its social meaning.
It hides its meaning, and it also defines that it's that line of demarcation between someone who's inside of the meaning and someone who's outside of the meaning.
Right.
And so even the like rush to define all of these memes and terms and explain all of their reference is almost proving the joke, because in order to watch people struggle with it and grapple with it and to be like, well, this thing evolved from the furry subculture and was posted on Tumblr in 2015. Like, that's another way of showing how far removed mainstream culture is from what was just expressed immediately and viscerally to someone who understood all of the references.
Now, one more thing about the joke aspect is that, is it related to the phenomenon of irony poisoning? There is a writer named Craig Johnson, who is going to be a future guest on the podcast here. He's the author of How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. And he points out and shows how humor is a conscious recruitment tool of right-wing actors. And so I'm wondering whether, in general, you agree with that.
I think that yes and no, I agree with it. I'd say, like, I don't know for certain, like maybe there are identity groups that are out there putting together playbooks that say we're going to create black-pilled memes in order to, you know, draw young people into our identity politics. But I think it's a little bit more subconscious than that. Especially like inside humor or even just like inside language, it's almost like once you've been drawn almost unconsciously toward a side of the spectrum, you're thereby more opened up to further appeals from where you already are. So
right.
I don't know that one could consciously create the kind of content that initially gets people in. It's more like a force of magnetism. and being drawn along by a current. And then once you're there sort of at the, you know, pooling places, like Nick Fuentes is a good example. His America First platform is like a place where people kind of end up and then go even further or come back out of the pipeline.
Right.
I think that you're sort of seeing the nexus of a lot of those connotations, a lot of the connotations of the content, but I don't think anyone is really capable of controlling things to the degree where they're saying, you know, we're going to run this like a traditional political campaign and these are our issues and we want people to believe that these scapegoats are, you know, ruining the country and this is how we're going to do that through Groyper memes, you know.
There's an additional complication in the uncertainty of the usage of memes and in all of the cultural drift that you're talking about is that what we have come to expect from the common categories of left and right politics can get very confused. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And I think that is in part by design, frankly. The fringe groups, these fringe groups specifically, but also fringe groups historically, will adopt postures that are adversarial or just rejected again by the mainstream and then combine them in ways that forge themselves more tightly together, in part because those postures would seem to be self-contradictory on their face. And it is almost a measure of ideological purity or you know, pledging oneself to the group to have these self-contradictory postures, which is how we get things like neo-Nazi trans folks, right?
Right.
And so it is almost like you are even further thereby outside of the mainstream by adopting things that munge stuff together that the normies would think completely don't go together, right?
I want to turn to Graham Platner because he's an important black box for a lot of folks at the moment. And many of the uncertainties around him come out of this very complex space that you navigate. Now, given what you know so far, how hard would it be to like reverse engineer how he wound up shitposting on Reddit and with a Nazi tattoo on his chest?
I mean, maybe this is a controversial take, but I don't actually see him as a particularly off the wall case. I think like, especially given where he was born and, you know, he was born in Maine and he had a family culture that was very self-sufficient, rugged individualist, grew up around guns. And his parents got a divorce. His father was in the professional class. He was a lawyer. I'm not exactly sure what his mother did, but she, I know, kind of had some trouble making ends meet after their divorce, if I'm correct.
Yeah, she was a business person. She ran a restaurant or a restaurant business. Yeah.
Small right. business owner. And so his road sort of, to me, is analogous. We could sort of see him as a through the glass darkly, or maybe not even, a close proxy to J.D. Vance, actually.
Right. Uh-huh.
Because these are two people who may have had some common denominators as young people, but both were sort of in and out of elite institutions, in and out of the military, kind of navigating their unstable identities through like, let's be honest, the lens of male white privilege in the United States right. in the 21st century. And I think, you know, when we look at his trajectory, we see somebody who was trying to deal with that anger and that grief and that, again, like lack of meaning that he experienced and looking for it wherever he could find it and probably still is to some extent looking for it. And so I think like there's, and J.D. Vance has some of that too, where he sort of flickers on the edge, or he did for a long time. I think he's probably kind of gone over the edge now, but
I think he's over the edge now. Right. But the period of Hillbilly Elegy right. is really ambiguous. He's walking a bunch of different lines there for sure.
And, you know, even just looking at J.D. Vance's allies, we have Peter Thiel, who is his, you know, his raison d'etre, basically. I mean, he would not be the vice president of the United States or even probably a politician at all, if not for Peter Thiel. And so you have
right.
these background forces that are very, institutional and very cathedral-esque in comparison to these, quote, working class or, you know, proletarian origins. And Plattner is, again, working with that tension as well. And I think the experience in the military and the experience of getting that tattoo, you know, you had floated some ideas about maybe this was his self-styled mark of Cain, that this is sort of a way of externalizing and making visible some of the pain and grief. I think that's probably a component of it, but I wonder, too, whether this wasn't the thrust of nihilism in his life a little bit as well, you know?
Well, he's certainly become a Rorschach test for how a number of liberals and leftists have to navigate a lot of different anxieties that I think you study in a fair amount of detail. So I've made a short list of questions that this story brings up for me, and maybe we can run through them for your insights. I mean, the first one is, like, what do men become vulnerable to in isolation, particularly on the internet?
Well, I'm not a man, so I will caveat that.
Right.
First off, I don't want to come across as saying that I understand this. I will say that I think men in isolation become prey to the same forces that all humans become prey to in isolation, which is meaninglessness, despair, grief, rage. And I think for men, the issue that I observe and that I experienced as being a part of some of these internet cultures in their nascency when I was in my teens, is the feeling that there is just no place for them to exist and no place for them to matter and no future that is worth investing in. And you see that with the acronym that a lot of the incel culture is identified with, which is NEET, N-E-E-T.
Yeah.
And that is not in education, employment, or training.
Right.
And that becomes a ideological stance. And it is seen as something that is a resistance to this very hegemonic idea of what it means to be a meaningful and valuable citizen in a late stage globalized capitalist society. And so I think where that can be a creative space, right? That can be a creative space to be in resistance. I think it's very hard because we have provided absolutely no structure for these folks to make their own sense of meaning and to come up with a constructive way to apply it. That then, and because they're surrounded by only consumerist ideals, that then becomes a grave vulnerability for getting drawn into nihilism. And so I think with the lack of connection that men can often feel with each other, that then becomes a place that you're just validating that nihilism over and over again.
There's a dyad that I became aware of as you started your answer between the irony or the tragedy of seeing that there is a population who does not know where they belong or where they can be in the world. It feels like there's an inverse relationship to the closure of, you know, in real life spaces and possibilities where you could be a person with a name, with an identity, with a mission or a purpose or something like that. And then somehow a toxic mimic of that is created online in the form of an anonymous identity that can't really do anything except, you know, produce affect and shitpost. It's weird. It's like there's a relationship between those two forms of, you know, actual presence and powerlessness masquerading as a kind of presence.
I think there's that dynamic is present, but I do actually think the internet is not broken. I think that the people who run the internet, on the other hand, are broken.
Right.
I think that, you know, technology as a tool is open to be used in ways that are destructive or ways that are constructive.
Right.
And I will say that in some very real ways, the internet and internet culture, especially the early internet culture, saved my life and really gave me a place to connect and to see a wider variety of options for myself in the future than I would have been able to,
had I just been stuck in a rural deep South place. And I do think that's still true for young people. I think the problem is that we have moved away from the ability to use these tools to construct new worlds rather than to get stuck in an eddy of, you know, almost navel gazing on how miserable everything is.
Right.
And that's no one's, that's no individual person's fault. It's not young people's fault. It is kind of the way the system has been engineered in order to make gobs of profit for very few people.
Okay, so in part two, I continue my questions on how Cantarell sees the Graham Platner story roll out in the context of the idea of narrative and shifting identities. So that's a wrap for episode six, except for drum roll. Fascist Dad of the Week. Dick Cheney is really the fascist corpse of the week, or last week, actually. The former vice president knew that his pretense of disarming WMDs for going to war in Iraq in 2003 was false, and approximately a million Iraqis died because of this neo-colonial aggression he pushed. Now, he died on the same day that Mamdani was elected, and I can only hope his version of hell was getting trapped as a ghost busboy for one of the bars packed with partiers on election night. I'm Matthew. That's it for this week. I'll see you over on Patreon for Cy Cantarell Part 2, or next week back here for an interview with the liberation theology and Jesuit ICE protester, David Inzoskis. Take care of each other.